The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the January-February issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. And we're going to go to page 8, Who's Who in Sports, second line. We have Kenneth Walker III, Michigan State Spartans running back. His height is 5'10". His weight is 210 pounds. He was born October 20th, 2000, hometown Arlington, Tennessee. Making his Michigan State debut after transferring from Wake Forest, Walker rushed for 264 yards against Northwestern. On his first carry, he rambled 75 yards for a touchdown. The junior was named first-team All-American and won the Duke Walker Award as the nation's top running back. Did you know the FBS record for most yards rushing in a game is held by Samaje Perine, who ran for 427 yards on 34 carries for Oklahoma against Kansas in 2014? Next, we have Drew Timmy, Gonzaga Bulldogs forward basketball. His height is 6'10". His weight is 235 pounds. He was born September 9th, 2000, in his hometown Richardson, Texas. A consensus preseason All-American, Timmy averaged 18 points during Gonzaga's first 9 games. As a sophomore, he averaged 19 points per game on 65% shooting as the Zags went 31-1 and advanced to the NCAA title game. During the tournament, he became famous for celebrating by smoothing his mustache. Did you know Gonzaga came within a game of an unbeaten season in 2021? The last undefeated national champ was Indiana, which went 32-0 in 1965-76. And finally, we have Jonathan India, Cincinnati Reds second baseman. His height is 6 feet. His weight is 200 pounds. He was born December 15, 1996, in his hometown, Coral Springs, Florida. After a season in which he hit 269 with 21 homers, India was named the National League Rookie of the Year. He received 29 of 30 first-place votes. At Florida, India was named the SEC Player of the Year in 2018, and he helped the Gators to the College World Series title in 2017. But did you know India was the 8th Cincinnati player to be named Rookie of the Year since its inception in 1947? The Dodgers have had 18 winners, twice as many as any other team. Continuing with history, records recovered, pages 20 through 21. We have Satchel Paige, 1944 Triple Crown. As an interview subject, Paige was as memorable as Yogi Berra. But as a pitcher, he was peerless. Among his most famous witticisms, age is a case of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter. He surely didn't mind being 37, as he pitched nearly perfectly for the Kansas City Monarchs in 1944. In the 14 starts accounted for, he struck out 85 batters in 87.2 innings, tossed 3 shutouts, and posted a 0.72 ERA. His run support wasn't the best. He went 6-3, but those 6 wins were enough to get him the Triple Crown. Paige would pitch his final 3 innings in 1965 for the Oakland Athletics at age 58. Tetelo Vargas, the Negro Leagues included both black and Latino players excluded from the Major League Baseball. Among the best Latino players of his era was Vargas, the Dominican Deer. Throughout the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, he played professionally in his native Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Canada, Cuba, and the United States. Once in the middle infielder, known for his blazing speed, Vargas had moved to center field when he batted 471 for the New York Cubans in 1943. Josh Gibson was right on his heels with a 466 mark, but no one else came close to 400. Mule Suttles, 1926 Triple Crown. Even among black stars of his era, Suttles was unheralded in the white press, playing in the shadow of Josh Gibson. But the Alabama-born first baseman and left fielder could hit as well as anyone. His 1926 season for the St. Louis Stars is well recorded and staggering. In 89 games, he had hit 79 extra base hits, 28 doubles, 19 triples, and 32 home runs, good for a .877 slugging percentage. Extrapolated it to a 162-game season, he would have had 51 doubles, 35 triples, and 58 homers, and 27 stolen bases. After his playing career, Suttles became a well-respected manager who mentored young black players who would follow Jackie Robinson to Major League Baseball. .71 era in 1937. ERA. Eugene Dremmer, probably the most well-known player mentioned here, Bremmer etched himself in the record books as a 20-year-old rookie for the Cincinnati Tigers in 1937, allowing just 4 earned runs and 50.2-thirds innings pitched. His .71 ERA that season narrowly edges out Page and Smith for the single-season mark. The lowest Major League Baseball ERA since the dead ball era is Bob Gibson's 1.17112 set in 1968. And though Bremmer would not rival the careers of the Monarchs' 1-2 punch, he wasn't a one-season wonder, appearing in 5 All-Star games. In his best season, he led the 1945 Cleveland Buckeyes to a World Series victory as their ace. Ray Brown. Though he died in obscurity, his obituary didn't even mention he played baseball. Brown has since gained recognition as one of the greatest pitchers of all time. His overdue induction into Cooperstown came in 2006. A 2-time champion for the Grays, Brown boasted a deep repertoire of pitches that included a knuckleball. He twice finished a season with a 1.88 ERA, including during an undefeated 14-0 season in 1938, when he led the league in shutouts, 4, and saves, 3. In 1940, he started 17 games and finished all of them. No one else is known to have more than 10 complete games that season. Undefeated in 1938. Next, we have Hilton Smith. To call Smith the Don Drysdale to Satchel Paige's Sandy Koufax would sell him short. On the Monarchs, Smith's job was to relieve Paige in close games and start on days Paige wasn't. In 1941, this dynamic duo combined for a 15-0 record, with Smith providing 10 of those wins. In 13 recorded appearances that season, Smith had 6 complete games and 3 saves. In Page's 1944 Triple Crown season, Smith matched his teammates' 0.72 ERA with a .79 mark of his own, allowing just 11 hits and 3 walks in 22 2/3 inning. Smith surrendered no runs in his one start during the Monarchs' 1942 World Series sweep of the Homestead Grays. What if money were no object? It shows a couple of pictures here of a couple of girls jumping rope, free popcorn. Money is ruining sports, or so they keep saying. Ever since Major League Baseball banned 8 members of the Chicago White Sox for allegedly taking bribes to throw the 1919 World Series, fans have worried about business tainting their beloved games. Those concerns have multiplied as leagues have become billion-dollar businesses. Money, money, money. Is it ruining sports? Asked the cover of a special 1978 issue of Sports Illustrated. Paying students to play would ruin college sports. Read the headline of a 2019 op-ed in the New York Times. All that dough has done some good. Money allows hard-working athletes to rise from humble beginnings to lives of comfort and security. Teams and players regularly use their position to raise funds for worthy causes. It is money that allows the production of magazines full of silly hypothetical articles like this one. But while cash might not be ruining sports, it makes certain aspects annoying. NFL games have so many TV timeouts, the broadcasts feel like one long ad. Stars are regularly put in the position of abandoning a team they like to get the best deal for themselves. The best seats in every arena often go to business people, entertaining clients who aren't even fans. And boy, have microtransactions made video games tedious. So, for the sake of better franchise modes in our games and better crowds in our stadiums, let's imagine a world without any money at all, in sports and otherwise. It may not be as impossible as it seems. There is an idea called the post-scarcity economy, a complicated-sounding term for a potential future in which no one needs money because there's nothing they need to buy, usually thanks to a technological breakthrough. This idea is, in part, the premise of the future in Star Trek. An invention called the replicator can easily 3D print anything a human might want, such as a turkey sandwich, T-shirt, or gold-plated fidget spinner. So humans spend less time making stuff and more time traveling through space. We're not interested in the galactic implications of a replicator-like invention, however. In a future in which humans don't need to pass the time doing menial tasks, what happens to our favorite pastimes? For starters, the very idea of professional sports would have to change. These days, going pro means crossing the threshold from unpaid amateur participation into the lucrative world of sponsorships and contracts. For many years, college stars went from unemployed to millionaires overnight. While NCAA players have recently started profiting off their own names, images, and likenesses, blurring the line of who counts as a pro, the line would simply cease to exist in a post-scarcity world. A professional athlete would be anyone who made a competitive activity their chosen vocation, whether that's an unknown marbles player or LeBron James the 24th. The freedom to do what you want could mean a lot more people trying to make the big leagues, and even more people tuning in. It could also mean a greater variety of games and activities get a chance to shine. The huge financial power of the biggest sports leagues create a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. More people play football and baseball because those sports offer a chance to one day become rich and famous. More fans watch baseball and football because they played those games growing up. And all those people tuning in give those leagues the revenue necessary to market their sport to even more new fans. But what if, well, are football, baseball, basketball, hockey, and soccer the five best sports in the world? Or are they just the lucky ones who got in early and used their profits to fortify their position? Can you say for certain that hi-lo isn't the greatest sport ever invented? I know I can't. And when everyone can just print out traditionally expensive equipment, the barrier to entry for unusual sports will never be lower. The game experience can all only improve in a cash-free world. Without high ticket prices, there will be more packed houses. And while you may not pay attention to what your parents pay, concession prices are ridiculous. When the whole menu is free, you will have a better argument for getting an ice cream helmet. No one naming rights deals will allow for more iconic stadium facades like Wrigley Fields. The biggest changes, however, would be in store for the people who profit the most from the current system. No longer will players be said to underperform or overperform relative to their salaries. And without a billionaire needed to cut their paychecks, the entire idea of an owner goes out the window. Really, the modern concept of a league wouldn't be needed either, as it mostly serves to consolidate the power and resources of the owners. When the only motivation for playing is seeking out the best competition, the top clubs can return to barnstorming, the practice of traveling far and wide to seek the best competition. Imagine a band of carefree fans following an NBA All-Star team around the world. Expense-free as it takes on all challengers. Sound fun? Well, one of you will have to invent that replicator first. Pay attention in science class for all our sakes. Hometown Heroes, pages 36 and 37. Hometown Heroes, don't stop believing. Detroit's Dylan Larkin wants to bring Hockey Town back to glory. The first Red Wings captain, Dylan Larkin, played in Detroit's NHL arena. He forgot his jersey. The mistake didn't make national news. He was, after all, only 10 years old and a member of the Lakeland Hawks, who were playing the Kensington Valley Rebels in the state finals. They ended up beating us, Larkin says. I had to wear someone else's jersey, and I was so nervous I don't think I played that well. But it was such a cool experience. I'll never forget how good the ice was. Larkin, 25, grew up in Waterford Township, Michigan, a 45-minute drive from the Wings' then-home Joe Louis Arena. That's why Detroit's previous two Stanley Cup wins in 2002 and 2008 are not just lofty standards for Larkin, but sources of fond memories. He recalls wear your jersey to school day and getting nights off from homework when the Wings were in the finals. In an era in which athletes rarely come up playing for teams they loved as kids, Larkin has managed to do something even more impressive, spending his entire career in Southeast Michigan. He won a Pee Wee State title in Detroit. He played for the United States National Development Team program, then based in nearby Ann Arbor as a teenager. He stayed in Ann Arbor after graduating from the program to play for the University of Michigan. And after a season for the Wolverines, he surprised many by making the Red Wings at just 19. He traveled all over the world as a member of Team USA. But the farthest from home he's ever been based was Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he played 6 playoff games for the Wings AHL affiliate after being drafted. Now, as if by fate, he's back home in Detroit, hoping to get some local kids out of doing their homework very soon. Lucky numbers. Larkin impressed his coaches every step of the way with his speed and leadership ability. Leading up to the 2014 NHL draft, experts projected the Michigan commit to go somewhere in the second half of the first round, around pick 20. The Red Wings had the 15th selection. Sitting in the crowd at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia, Larkin turned to his parents as Detroit was on the clock and asked them, "Wouldn't this be so cool?" Sure enough, when Red Wings GM Ken Holland started to announce it, "I had a great feeling," Larkin says. "It's one of those moments that's a blur. You're so excited." Time went by so fast. When I talk to kids that are going to the draft, I tell them, enjoy it and soak it all in. Take a second to look around. I didn't do that. I just buried my head and tried not to trip going up the stairs. One of Larkin's biggest challenges adjusting to the Red Wings was picking a number. One of the NHL's oldest and most successful franchises, Detroit has retired 8 numbers, with a few more unofficially retired and no longer issued. Larkin's first number growing up was 99, retired throughout hockey in honor of Wayne Gretzky. Then he wore 19 as his older brother Colin idolized Canucks over center Marcus Nyslund, and Dylan idolized Colin. The number 19 is retired by Detroit for its former captain and Larkin's current boss, Steve Yzerman. Its inverse, 91, belonged to Yzerman's legendary teammate, Sergei Fedorov. He lost his second and third choices, 25 and 17, to veterans. So Larkin wears 71, a number significant for its insignificance in Red Wings lore. No one wore it for more than a season before Larkin. All that incredible franchise history was not so far in the past for Larkin. His favorite Red Wing growing up was Heinrich Zetterberg, who had led the team to that 2008 Cup. In his rookie season, Larkin often played on the Wing's top line with his idol. He finished the year with 23 goals and had 22 assists and potted his first playoff goal against the Lightning. I don't think I can really put into words the transition from being a fan and idolizing him to playing with him and becoming friends with him and ultimately learning from him, Larkin says. That playoff appearance was the 25th in a row for Detroit, a streak that started in 1990-91, 5 years before Larkin was born. The Wings haven't made the postseason since. While Larkin's time with Zetterberg was a special one, it was also a transition. In 2018-2019, after Zetterberg's retirement, Larkin had his best season yet, registering 32 goals and 41 assists in 76 games. His team, however, finished just 32-40-10. Now a city used to winning is counting on its native son to deliver them back to glory. Veteran presence. In January 2021, the Red Wings announced that Larkin would be the team's 37th captain. It's first since Zetterberg. The honor reflects that he's the team's best player and a leader in the community. Larkin has volunteered his time at Special Olympics in Waterford and teamed up with his dad, who works in the beauty industry, to donate extra gloves and masks to local hospitals during the COVID pandemic. Now he's living up to the responsibility of the captaincy on the ice. Before the NHL paused its season before the holidays, Larkin led the resurgent Red Wings with 29 points, 15 goals, 14 assists in 27 games. Detroit was 15-13-3 at the break, on pace for its first winning season since 2015-2016. And Larkin, who got to live his dream a few short years ago by playing with his idols, already finds himself in the opposite position, leading a pair of star rookies to Swedish winger Lucas Raymond and German defenseman Moritz Seider. The Wings' success also owes to a hometown reunion. They traded in the offseason for starting goalie Alex Nedeljkovic, an old friend of Larkin from his under-16 team. Now a fairy tale career seems destined for a storybook ending. But for Larkin, the idea of the hometown hero ending the title drought is almost beyond comprehension. It's something I've thought about, and I don't even know how much excitement I would have, Larkin says. I don't even know what I would do with the cup. I think I would probably just bring it to the center of Waterford and have everyone spend some time with it. We're going to go back to page 36. Actually, page 36 and 37. Heroes in the making. These stars are trying to put their birthplaces on top. Kawhi Leonard, Los Angeles. Injuries have so far tempered the excitement around Leonard's homecoming. The Clippers star, however, has a proven ability to come back healthy and win a ring. Charlie Collier, Dallas. So she played high school ball in Houston and spent her college days in Austin. The Wings are Texas's only WNBA team. It's a big state, but this number one draft pick is hero enough for all of it. And John Tavares, Toronto. Not every native Ontarian signs with the Leafs, but Tavares did. Now he's the leader of a Toronto team with enough talent to end a 55-year title drought and make its captain a local legend. Then we have a picture right in the middle of the page. The Kismet Kid, Little Larkin. Larkin may be young, but he's been wearing the red and white for longer than any teammates. Historical hometowners. Local players used to be more common. Here are some of the best ever. Jermaine Kearse, Seattle. Before making the most famous catch in Seahawks history during Super Bowl XIX, Kearse grew up 40 miles before Super Bowl 39. Kearse grew up 40 miles from Seattle on Fort Lewis. He is currently an assistant coach for the Washington Huskies football team, for whom he had 29 receiving TDs as a player. Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax, Brooklyn and Los Angeles. Despite growing up on opposite ends of the country, Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax were both hometown heroes for the Dodgers. In the 1956 and 57 seasons, they pitched together in Colfax and Brooklyn. And before 1958, the franchise moved to Drysdale, native Los Angeles. Maurice Richard, Montreal. In the first seven NHL drafts, 1963-69, there existed a rule that gave the Habs dibs on French-Canadian players. They rarely used it to much effect. Their legendary success owes more to local legends like the Rocket Richard, who had worked his way up the Habs farm system after signing as a team. Hometown villains. Not every kid becomes a local legend. After all, the Joker is from Gotham City, too. Peyton Manning, New Orleans. While he's the greatest Manning of all time, he wasn't the first. Dad Archie played most famously for the Ole Miss and the New Orleans Saints. That gave Peyton, who played high school ball at New Orleans' Isidore Newman, plenty of connections to the Deep South. But Peyton forged his own path in football, beating Ole Miss twice as Tennessee's QB before getting drafted by the Colts. In his NFL career, he had a higher passing rating, 121, against the Saints than any other opponent, but lost to them in Super Bowl 45. Kobe Bryant, Philadelphia. Philadelphians don't need an excuse to boo anyone. The town that infamously jeered Santa Claus at an Eagles game in 1968 showed no mercy to the native son who had brought the state championship to local Lower Merion High School. At the 2002 All-Star game in Philly, the crowd booed Bryant every time he touched the ball. It didn't stop him from winning game MVP, but he admitted during an in-game interview, "My feelings are hurt, being from Philadelphia." In his final game in Philly in 2015, however, the home crowd showed Bryant how they really felt with a standing ovation. Dale Havrichuk, Toronto. No metro area produces NHLers quite like Toronto that leads to the Maple Leafs fans constantly hatching schemes to bring other squads. Maple Leaf Gardens as an 18-year-old, Winnipeg Jets rookie in 1982. Mark Teixeira, Baltimore. When first baseman Teixeira reached free agency after the 2008 season, the Orioles saw an opportunity to maybe snag an elite player on a hometown discount. The Maryland native, however, didn't seem keen to take less money to play for a team coming off 11 straight losing seasons. Ultimately, the slugger took $180 million to play for the Yankees instead. It seemed like the reasonable choice to everyone but the fans of Camden Yards. Teixeira, who led the league in homers as the Yanks went on to win the World Series. We've run out of the time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.